Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Protests all over this week on UAW picket lines outside GM plants while a lightning strike lasted, in New York against Iran's president, in Washington and Europe against George Bush's greenhouse gas plants, and in Myanmar with bloodied monks in the streets and a government crackdown. Democratic presidential contenders debated again as Hillary seemed to cement a lead. The top half of the Republican field was a no-show for a black voters forum. Home sales and prices tumble again. Up next on Point, a week in the news with top analysts Jack Beatty and you. Joining us this week from Washington is Anne Kornblut, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. She's been covering the presidential candidates and the Democrats' debate in New Hampshire this week. Anne, welcome back to the roundtable.
Thank you very much.
And joining us from Washington, Barbara Slavin, diplomatic correspondent for USA Today. Her big new book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation, is right on the news this week. It'll be in bookstores very soon. Barbara, great to have you.
Thank you very much.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Ann, and Barbara.
Let's go straight to that kind of epic. It'll live in the news history books, a confrontation between Lee Bollinger and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad at Columbia. The president of Columbia University dove right in.
Let's then be clear at the beginning. Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator. And so I ask you, why have women, members of the Baha'i faith, homosexuals, and so many of our academic colleagues become targets of persecution in your country?
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that's not how we treat guests in our country, and said he was offended by that biting introduction.
In many parts of his speech, there were many insults and claims that were incorrect, regretfully. Of course, I think that he was affected by the press, the media, and the political sort of mainstream line that you read here.
Barbara Slavin, this is right in your wheelhouse. Where does this relationship stand at the end of this high theatrics week in New York?
That's a really good question. I mean, there was a lot of talking, but was anybody really listening to each other? I think that is the real question. I came away with it. I have to confess, I spent more hours with Ahmadinejad than I would have anticipated. I went to Colombia. I saw him speak at the UN. I went to a dinner with a group of media people and think tankers, and then I saw him in a meeting with religious activists, anti-war activists. So plenty of time to watch. And I think that it was not entirely useless, we saw little glimmers and glints that he was beginning to understand the depth of feeling about some of these issues, and that it doesn't just come from the administration, that it comes from the American people generally. But we're really going to have to wait and see whether there's any change in Iranian policy, any change in Bush administration policy toward Iran.
Anne Kornblut, what did you hear on the campaign trail about U.S.-Iran relations? I mean, there are all this talk of whispers of war in the background. Are people taking that seriously? What wheels do you feel turning in Washington?
Well, I would say certainly on the Democratic side, which stole a lot of the thunder this week, this was an opportunity to talk about what mistakes were made during Iraq. We heard during the debate former Senator John Edwards saying that he had learned a lesson from his vote in Iraq. And there was a vote this week in the Senate that he drew a comparison to, labeling the Iranian government, the Iranian controlling party, a terrorist entity. And so he used this as an opportunity to say that the senators who voted to agree that it's a terrorist entity, and namely Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, are heading down the same path that we had headed towards in Iraq. But in general, this was actually a really interesting substantive moment for a lot of them on the campaign trail. We heard a lot of discussion of it as opposed to just grandstanding about it. And I have to say, as a Columbia graduate myself, I listened with great interest to what Bollinger said. It was really kind of a different week on the campaign trail. trail in that sense.
Jack, this Iran-U.S. trail did go back to Washington, and movement this week on Iraq's Republican Guard, this kind of elite military parallel or different from its normal military that was born out of the 1979 Islamic Revolution there. Action in Washington this week and reports today that the White House will move to technically, formally label this a terrorist organization, which allows them to clamp down on funding. And this is a group that's into a lot of business as well. What do you see in those votes and that maneuvering, Jack?
Well, it was quite a vote. It was 76-22. A majority of Democrats voted for the resolution that effectively declares the Islamic Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization. Jim Webb eloquently, I think, said that this could be read, quote, as tantamount to a declaration of war. What do we do with terrorist organizations, he asked. If they are involved against us, we attack them. And now we know that Senator Clinton was one of those who voted for it. Biden and Dodd did not. You know, now I think what we have is the president seems to want a confrontation with Iran. We know that Cheney has been pushing for it. The Democrats now, it seems to me, have given him a green light, a majority have. The leading Democratic presidential candidate has. And so who are we left with to stop any move against Iran? It seems to be the military. According to Dana Priest in the Washington Post, the military, quote, would revolt.
The U.S. military, the Pentagon.
The U.S. military, if the administration pushed ahead with an attempt to attack Iran, that Admiral Fallon has been quoted as saying, he's the CENTCOM commander, an attack will not happen on my watch.
Because they don't have the strength in reserve anymore to do it.
That they do not, and that this effectively, this seems to be the only thing holding them back. Now, you say Bush would never do it if the military were going to revolt against him. Well, the Joint Chiefs unanimously recommended against the surge. He went ahead with the surge. So we're left in the strange position where the opposition party has essentially given a green light, it seems to me, and the only thing holding it back is the military.
We'll turn to that Democratic debate up your way in New Hampshire, Jack, but let's listen for a moment first to Virginia Senator and veteran James Webb. On Wednesday, the Senate did vote for a non-binding resolution to encourage the White House to declare Iran's Revolutionary Guard unit a terrorist organization. News now, the White House is probably going to do that formally soon. Webb, Democrat, war veteran, reacted strongly.
This is not the way to make foreign policy. It's not the way to declare war, although this cleverly worded sense of the Congress could be interpreted that way. Those who regret their vote 5 years ago to authorize military action in Iraq should think hard before supporting this approach, because in my view, it has the same potential to do harm where many are seeking to do good.
Barbara Slavin, what about it? In this move toward this particular declaration, the framework for potential war being laid?
I hope not. But let me say a few words about the Revolutionary Guard Corps, because I think there's widespread ignorance about this organization within this country. First of all, it is, in effect, the regular armed forces of Iran. There is no distinction anymore between the regular armed forces and the Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Oh, I'm reading just the opposite right here today, but that's okay.
Yeah, it has an air force, a navy, ground troops. Its commanders are interchanged with those of the quote-unquote regular forces. There is no distinction. It is the elite military force of Iran. It has certain special units which carry out unsavory activities and are involved, as was mentioned, in business and of various types. But you know, many of its companies are sort of like the Army Corps of Engineers. They do a lot of construction projects, that sort of thing. And there is a widespread division of opinion within the Revolutionary Guard Corps, as there is within Iranian society as a whole, about the current leadership of the country and the policies it pursues. To declare the entire organization a terrorist organization will simply unify what is not a unified group against the United States, will convince many people that there's no point in trying to to talk to the West, and that they should accelerate their nuclear program as quickly as possible and prepare for an American attack. So I think this is one of those feel-good things that the Democrats and others do, that politicians do, that that could backfire. And I mean, U.S. already has extensive sanctions on Iran and on entities connected to the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So to go this extra step is merely a propaganda exercise, in my view, and a dangerous one.
Right back at the beginning of the week, on Sunday, Hillary Clinton sat down with George Stephanopoulos and was asked about the war. Rush Limbaugh jumped all over her position, dissecting it, saying, look, this is basically the president's position. Let's listen to a clip from the Stephanopoulos interview, and then Rush comes in to give his take.
You know, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals and make pledges because I don't know what I'm going to inherit, George. I don't know, and neither do any of us know, what will be the situation in the region. How much more aggressive will Iran have become? What will be happening in the Middle East? How much more of an influence will the chaos in Iraq have in terms of what's going on in the greater region? Will we have pushed al-Qaeda in Iraq out of their strongholds with our new partnership with some of the tribal sheikhs, or will they have regrouped and retrenched?
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't really quite know what to say here. She has just outlined the position of George W. Bush and General Petraeus, to whom she said to listen to would require willing suspension of disbelief.
Okay, there's Rush Limbaugh on Hillary Clinton, on George Stephanopoulos, and Kornblut. Rush says, hey, this is what the president says. We can't know what's going to happen. We can't make promises. You know, we're there.
And there are a lot of Democrats who agree with him. This is one of the tricky things about her position so far. I will say that she's not that far off from Barack Obama at this point. They've all said that they need to wait and see where things are, and that will depend on the facts on the ground. The only Democratic contenders who've not said that are Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico, who has said he would be able to start withdrawing immediately and would set a firm deadline for getting all of the troops out, leaving none behind. And of course, Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, who said he would have them all out yesterday if he were elected. But it's an interesting dilemma for her, because on the one hand, she has tried to really run to the left and say, for about the last year or so, to say that although she's not apologizing for her vote, she would be the one who, if President Bush did not get the troops out, she would begin to do the day she is elected, as she said on the campaign trail almost every day for the past since she announced in January. But on the other hand, she is actually looking to what she would do as president. Her advisors talk about the concrete plans she is laying for being president. Perhaps that's presumptuous, some might say, but that's what she's doing. And in that sense, she's trying to leave herself as much room as possible.
Jack, you were at the debate, I think, in New Hampshire this week. Let's listen to just a little bit of Hillary there, and we'll hear from others as well. But here she is. Tim Russert poses the question. She talks about her views on ending the Iraq War. Here's the question from Russert.
Senator Clinton, Democrats all across the country believed in 2006, when the Democrats were elected to the majority in the House and Senate, that that was a signal to end the war, and the war would end. You have said that you will not pledge to have all troops out by the end of your first term, 2013. Why not?
Well, Tim, it is my goal to have all troops out by the end of my first term. But I agree with Barack. It is very difficult to know what we're going to be inheriting.
We'll hear from Barack, but first, here's Edwards faced with the same question.
Senator Edwards, will you commit that at the end of your first term in 2013, all U.S. troops will be out of Iraq?
I cannot make that commitment. I can tell you what I would do as president. When I'm sworn into office come January of 2009, if there are, in fact, as General Petraeus suggests, 100,000 American troops on the ground in Iraq, I will immediately draw down 40,000 to 50,000 troops. And over the course of the next several months, continue to bring our combat troops out of Iraq until all of our combat troops are, in fact, out of Iraq.
Okay, we might as well hear from, going right on down the line, Tim Russert then has also asking there Senator Barack Obama if he would pledge to have American troops out of Iraq by the end of his first term, 2013.
I think it's hard to project 4 years from now, and I think it would be irresponsible. We don't know what contingency will be out there. What I can promise is that if there are still troops in Iraq when I take office, which it appears there may be, unless we can get some of our Republican colleagues to change their mind and cut off funding without a timetable, if there's no timetable, then I will drastically reduce our presence there to the mission of protecting our embassy, protecting our civilians, and making sure that we're carrying out counterterrorism activities there.
Okay, Jack Beatty, there they are in debate, the Democrat contenders for the White House. 2013, will we be out of Iraq? No promises.
No promises. Now, this sets up quite a debate in the fall. That is fall of 2008. We're going to have a Republican candidate, probably Rudy Giuliani, saying, stay the course in Iraq. And we're going to have a Democratic candidate, if it's Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, pretty much saying the same thing. They have removed this issue. I think Hillary has effectively removed it from the political debate, as Rush Limbaugh, I think, rightly charges. And, you know, the same thing happened in 2004. The Democrats nominated a candidate who could not use the main issue against the president, the issue of this catastrophic war, because, of course, he voted for it. And then in the middle of the campaign, John Kerry said, if I had it to do all over again, I'd do it. This is how great parties split up. This is how great parties die, when they cannot bring to the voters a clear decision on major national policy. And it's not only a matter of politics. The other thing that struck me in that debate was the poverty of strategic thinking among these people. I mean, the assumption that we're going to keep troops there indefinitely essentially puts no pressure whatsoever upon the Iranian factions to compromise. You know, President Kennedy put it very well in his last interview about the South Vietnamese. He said, in the final analysis, it's their war. It's their country. And so long as we have people there with this carte blanche commitment, there is no incentive for the political settlement that these candidates profess to want.
And Kornblith, there's a pretty dire analysis of the Democrat situation. Jack Beatty says this is how great parties die. Do you feel that fear afoot or something else in the debate?
I guess I have to disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not the historical analysis, but I do think that at least if we start with the Clinton campaign, they're banking on a desire to return to the stability and at least the predictability of the 1990s, not only domestically, economically, but also when it comes to foreign policy. And Hillary Clinton, of course, has looked at the example of the Balkans and said, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that if we get some kind of political stability, we can leave troops there to protect our own or to try and continue to pursue terrorism in the region. We're not just going to jump ship. We didn't do that in the Balkans. We're not going to do that there. I do agree with Jack, though, that there is incredible frustration within the party that there's no clear-cut way of confronting the Republicans on this. It's still roiling under the surface. The anger over the original vote seems to have dissipated a great deal, despite the efforts of certain candidates, in particular Obama and Edwards, to revive it. The real frustration now is, as Jack said, there aren't any absolutely clear choices. Again, some of the contenders, Clinton, Biden, would say, that's it. That's messy foreign policy. Sorry, it can't be easier. Mm.
Let's move over to the Republicans' debate this week. Well, a forum anyway. Lots didn't show up at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Tavis Smiley had a kind of black voters forum going there. Tom Joyner was there. Radio host Tom Joyner gave a shout out at the very beginning to the absent Republican presidential candidates.
And let me take a moment right here and now to say hello to those of you viewing from home. Mayor Rudy Giuliani, Senator John McCain, Governor Mitt Romney, and Senator Fred Thompson.
Former Arkansas Governor and contender Mike Huckabee said he was embarrassed.
I'm embarrassed for our party, and I'm embarrassed for those who did not come, because there's long been a divide in this country, and it doesn't get better when we don't show up.
Okay, Barbara Slavin, what do you see in that exchange and in the no-shows of the top of the Republican ticket there?
Well, I'm not an expert on domestic politics, so I should probably defer to Anne, but I would presume that they didn't see any percentage in showing up because they don't anticipate that there would be a large African-American vote for the Republican Party. I think it's a pity.
And Republicans writing off the black vote in this next election? There was so much talk, you know, not so many years ago about bringing in minority voters to the GOP.
Yes, absolutely. I will say that Barbara's exactly right. They didn't see much percentage. They're off fundraising. It's near the end of the third quarter. It ends on Sunday. They need to raise that money. And they all made sure to be in far-flung places where there was no possibility of their returning here. But this is a sharp turnabout. This is actually a heartbreak for the former Republican National Committee Chairman, Ken Mellman, who I believe, really genuinely felt that the party could expand by picking up minorities, of course, Hispanics. That was a necessity, just demographically speaking, but also reaching out as the party of Lincoln to African-American voters. That simply hasn't happened. It didn't happen in 2004 and 2006, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen again in 2008.
Let's turn to our listeners. Andrea is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to let you know that when I heard that Hillary had voted to name the Iranian government as a terrorist organization, first time I have to call in. I am shocked and appalled. I'm an undecided Democratic voter, and where the common sense that is lacking in our leadership is astounding to me. It's just astounding.
Well, let me ask you, Andrea. You know, this Quds Force within the Revolutionary Guard, they are reported, I guess it's pretty well known, to lend support to the Hezbollah in Lebanon, to Hamas, to Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So is there some element of fairness in the label, or do you see it as pure posturing? What?
Absolutely. This is not a good organization, no question about it. But labeling them as terrorists and then possibly the next step as war is the wrong way to go. We don't have the stomach for it. I don't have the stomach for it, and I feel betrayed by one of the candidates.
So what candidate does this turn you toward?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
You and maybe others. Andrea, thanks very much. Let's get a call from Mary in Iowa City. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you. You know, the greatest worry we have right now is Blackwater, because Blackwater is trying to get domestic contracts. And so it's a book out there called Blackwater. I'm saying that Chris Hedges wrote it, but I'm not sure. I can't remember the author. In that book, he shows that one day Blackwater is going to challenge the U.S. military and win. And if you can use Blackwater, you can override Posse Comitatus. We've got domestic worries. And besides these people clowning around at being president, we've got some real serious matters to, you know, as American people in general.
Mary, let us pick that up. Barbara Slavin, it has not been a good couple of weeks for Blackwater private security in Baghdad, and there's talk of them looking for contracts back home now. Mary says she fears almost a competition between private and public armed forces in this country.
Well, I think that's going a little bit too far, but clearly it has been a bunch of very, very bad weeks for this organization. It goes back, I guess, to the original strategy for the war, which was to go in light without sufficient troops to protect even our own installations. And so there's been a tremendous amount of outsourcing to these kinds of organizations. I mean, in defense of Blackwater, it's a very, very difficult situation that they're in. These guys are understandably jumpy and afraid for their lives and afraid for the lives of the people that they're trying to protect. But, you know, who do you blame? Do you blame the chicken or the egg in this case? I don't know. Nevertheless, there are investigations, of course. The Iraqi government is furious. It does appear that innocent civilians were killed by Blackwater contractors. And it's going to make it even more difficult, I'm afraid, for Americans to operate within Iraq, particularly outside the Green Zone.
Mary, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Tom in Boston. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to go to Burma, and I wanted to talk about Burma, hopefully, back in the early 80s. It's a beautiful country, and ever since then I've been sort of keeping tabs on it. And I think it's tragic that that country has gone through what it's gone through for, 45 or plus years or so since Uy Mwin took over. And I'm just wondering if there's, you know, what kind of leverage do we have now? And I can't help but see the irony also of democracy in Burma versus democracy in Iraq. And I actually emailed the White House after we invaded Iraq to say, you know, what's the matter with Burma? It's not strategically placed enough and doesn't have the resources enough.
Tom, let us talk about leverage there. Here's Australian Prime Minister John Howard saying he's upset, wants something done.
It's an appalling situation, and I join other international leaders in condemning what the regime is doing. We're going to introduce some targeted financial sanctions against regime leaders, and we will also examine if other measures can be taken.
So there's the Australian leader. President Bush spoke about Myanmar on the United Nations on Tuesday. Of course, that was before the crackdown began. It came anyway. Barbara Slavin, how much leverage does, I don't know, the United States, for starters, have? And maybe if there's greater leverage elsewhere, I don't know, China, do they intend to use it?
Yeah, the United States doesn't have much leverage. A lot of reporters were very surprised by Bush's speech, especially when he talked about additional sanctions, because we've had comprehensive sanctions on Burma, Myanmar, whatever you want to call it, since 2003. And there really isn't much left to do. In fact, I was emailed a copy of Talking Points that said, and the U.S. government will put sanctions on XX leaders.
Somebody,
and,
somewhere.
You know, and do XX, you know, so it was almost as though he was just searching for something to say. And his timing, of course, was exquisite, given that as soon as he called for freedom there, the leadership cracked down.
Right. Boom.
So I'm not sure he did them any favors. But the Chinese, indeed, do have leverage. They're the major economic partner for Burma. I talked to an Asia expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington, a guy named Derek Mitchell, who said that what he hoped would happen is that we could Darfurize this.
And, Darfurize? What,
yeah,
what is
which
that?
I think
that doesn't
is
sound
newer...
great. That doesn't
no,
sound so
but
great.
No, but in the good sense, in the sense that one could shame the Chinese into really using their leverage to try to convince the government there to stop killing people and to reach an accord with its opposition. You know, China has taken strides in the past year, in particular past months, in pushing the Khartoum government on Darfur because it's worried about its image before the 2008 Olympics. So perhaps it's possible to Darfurize this in a good sense.
Jack, we talk about Darfurizing. I mean, the very phrase seems to hold up the inability of Washington to have any command and control over events here.
Indeed. I'm glad to hear. I didn't know, Barbara, that the Chinese had been responding to that pressure. We've talked about it on this show, and especially the Olympic lever. And if it's working, well, maybe it can work in Burma, too.
Gripping images out of Myanmar this week. We'll talk about that more on Monday, go in depth on who stands where in the international community. Right now, Janine is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Janine, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is about GM and the strike they recently had.
Yeah.
I think as far as the resolution that came so quickly, I think that the workers are going to regret their decision, as well as the to begin to take over some of the health care expenses. I think that was a clever, manipulative move by the corporation to kind of eventually start the death of the union by having their workers be an antagonistic position against them on the health care issue.
The unions divide. I mean, the workers divide against their own union on health care once they offload it there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Once the union begins to take care of or adopt some of the costs for health care, then the workers. We pitted, in a sense, against their own union when it comes to health care decisions.
Yeah, but GM said they had to have that to keep investment, essentially to keep investment in this country. First nationwide strike, as short as it was, in three decades. And Kornblut, what about the interaction here of settlement and health care out of the GM labor negotiation?
Well, obviously, another way of looking at the settlement is that the more positive reflection of it is that now they will, in essence, have some more control over it themselves. And by taking it off the GM books, the company will be more solvent and they will potentially have jobs further into the future. So it's actually seemed to me a rare case of the unions and the company having some shared interests here. It was interesting on the campaign trail, though, that this came on the heels of a very lively debate a week ago about health care after Hillary Clinton rolled hers out and the role that her health care plan out for universal health care. And the questions now about what kind of role the government should play, employers should play, it seems almost without question now that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to run on health care. They've done it before, sure, but it seems this time that it's actually within the top two or three issues. It comes immediately after Iraq as the one that's most important to people. And the longer it's in the headlines, and as it was this past week with GM, in a way that every employee of any company can relate to, I think the more likely it is that's going to be a very active debate for the next year or so.
Jack Beatty, I'm looking at numbers here. The portion of American firms offering health benefits has fallen to 60% this year. It was 69% in 2000, so it continues down. And this is from Kaiser Family Foundation. They also say benefits packages are getting stingier. Last year, 38% of workers had deductibles of $500 or more, up from 14% in 2000. I mean, the employer's part of that package, it's getting bigger because prices are going up, but it's getting smaller as a percentage of what's going on.
It sure is, and never has the case for national health insurance of some kind seemed more obvious. You know, and it's to me sort of an index of the lack of imagination of these car companies that they have not and are still not even staggering. Well, GM was until yesterday under the weight of these health expenditures, that they weren't leading the effort to have national health insurance. This, of course, would take the burden off them and other great employers and put it on all taxpayers to pay for a decent system. And, you know, but we have a preview of what the debate is going to be about this with the children's health care debate in the Senate, where this proposal to give to expand this really excellent program that's been working for years, that has strong Republican support, Grassley, Orrin Hatch, conservative Republicans were brandishing the S word, socialism. That's what we're headed for. You give these kids health care, and by gosh, that's the beginning of it all. We'll be on the road to socialize medicine tomorrow. And that's, of course, already what the Republicans are saying about the Democratic plan.
But the Republicans saying just the opposite, too. In fact, in fairness, Jack, Senator Charles Grassley, Iowa, said it was intellectually dishonest to make that kind of accusation.
Oh, no, I understand, and I said that, that Orrin Hatch and others have been for this, but the most conservative senators, the 20-some-odd, are against it, and the Republican candidates, Rudy Giuliani, has already brandished the word socialism against Hillary. And it'll be interesting to see whether Hillary, who seems to have now backed way down on Iraq, whether she'll back further up under this ideological assault.
I want to look at another issue this week that intersects with GM and the auto industry, and of course, that's around greenhouse gases, a big climate conference at the UN, and then President Bush and Condoleezza Rice holding their own in Washington of major, emitters. I guess that's a nice word for polluters. President Bush speaking this morning at a press conference, called on global warming in his speech, called on nations to work together to curb greenhouse gas emissions, but it's not a binding UN mandate that he wants.
Together, our nations will pave the way for a new international approach on greenhouse gas emissions. This new approach must involve all the world's largest producers of greenhouse gas emissions, including developed and developing nations. We will set a long-term goal for reducing global greenhouse gas emissions. By setting this goal, we acknowledge there is a problem. And by setting this goal, we commit ourselves to doing something about it.
There's a problem. We're going to set long-term goals, but don't tread on me. The message behind it, it'll be individual countries with their own goals and their own programs. Barbara Slavin, how is this being received internationally?
With considerable skepticism. I mean, without hard and fixed goals and timetables and so on. I mean, if it's just going to be an aspiration, a goal, not a fixed quota of some sort, it's hard to see how it's really going to do any good. I mean, I'm told that this is an urgent problem, that we have to do something about it within the next 10, 20 years, or we may see drastic changes in the way that we all live on this planet, and many animals, species will go extinct. We're going to see rising sea levels and all the rest. So I think there's still a great deal of skepticism and concern that the Bush administration is not demonstrating sufficient urgency.
Ann Kornblut, is this a front on which the Democrats offer a markedly different program? I mean, I'm reading here about Europeans and others saying we just have to hunker down and wait for a Democratic administration, or hope for one, on the climate front.
Well, it was interesting, not in the most recent Democratic debate, but in the one before, Governor Richardson said that, of course, Al Gore had been correct in heralding this issue, and I'm just glad he's not running. This, of course, has been the issue that if he were to get into the race, which I highly doubt will happen, would have been his signature issue. But he's really driven the debate, and in essence, Democrats all agree there needs to be a better, in their words, environmental policy, and they, of course, tie it to energy policy and energy independence. So I do think that they're almost in unison on it, to the point where it's not really a debate within the primary.
Let's take a call. Jack, please.
But they didn't have the courage to say, yes, we have to increase the gas tax as a first step, as Alan Greenspan rightly says.
Let's take a call from Joe in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was disgusted by the Democratic debate, the supposedly top tier that's been anointed by the media all of them saying they couldn't get out of Iraq, promised to be there by 2013. My God, what a joke. Kucinich says they can be out 3 months after he's inaugurated. Kucinich comes out for insurance, health care, not health insurance, which Hillary Clinton says forced insurance because she's bought and paid for by the insurance companies. I can't believe how different Kucinich is and how little attention he gets. The anointed media just tell us we have to have Tweedledum and Tweedledee, which we've done for the last five elections, and we always end up with crap.
Joe, you think it's all the media's fault that he's down at the bottom of the polls?
Well, the media is the self-fulfilling prophecy. They give him attention, and then they poll, and they say, oh, yeah, I've heard of Hillary, I've heard of Obama, but I've never heard of this guy.
Okay.
And so naturally, he gets on TV, they're always focusing on these three.
Yeah, Joe, we've got it. And that brush could hit any of us, but we'll turn to you. You're covering
the
debates this week. Sure. What do you say to Joe?
Well, I would say that the reason that he's heard of Kucinich and heard what Kucinich has to say is because the media has covered him, and he's been included in the debates.
Yes, but you take his point. I mean, yes,
of course I do. Absolutely. Look, the Democrats are running by and large as a centrist party still, and on issues like Iraq, sure, logistically they would be capable of getting out of Iraq within 3 months, as Kucinich has suggested. But as a matter of policy, they've decided that that wouldn't be a prudent strategy to map out. I think this is part of what is going to make this debate lively over the next few months, and we'll see what happens. We'll see how Kucinich fares.
Joe, I don't know if you're going to find satisfaction there, but Jack?
Outside the debate hall at on the Dartmouth column, there were lots of Hillary signs, huge signs, lots of Biden, well, some Biden, and lots of Obama and so on. And I saw one sign for Dennis held by a woman whom I think I've seen up here at several anti-war demonstrations. I think that's an index of, unfortunately, where he's going. He made a good remark, I thought, a good quip, where he said, you can vote for somebody who will keep us in the war in Iraq and will not give us national health care, or you can vote for someone who's short.
You know, right. You know, and still and yet, with all the buzz online around Kucinich, Ron Paul, there's interesting ferment at the edges of this. Joe, thanks for your call. John's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Tom, how are you?
Well.
Good day. And guest. The most important issue I heard was on your program earlier this week, when you had Norman Podoros on, and the fact that I heard him say or heard it discussed that he is now a foreign affairs advisor to Rudy Giuliani,
mm-hmm.
And this man is the architect of our current involvement in Iraq, and one of the architects of the neocon philosophy, I cannot in good conscience support Rudy Giuliani, and I was taking a good strong look at him, and you know I'm a dyed-in-the-wool independent.
So on the Republican side, if not Giuliani, where might you turn, John?
I'm afraid I will have to look elsewhere. He would have been the only candidate I would have looked at. Romney, being from Massachusetts, I have seen the utter fraud that Mitt Romney is, Willard Mitt Romney. He was an absentee governor for 2 years. People, you know, remember his father brought us a Rambler, so...
hey, don't condemn the man for a car, but we've got your point, John, and let us pick it up. Barbara Slavin, what about it? We did talk to Norman Podhoretz this week. His new book is World War IV, and he's got a very strong and kind of alarming view of what's going on in the world and is said to be a senior foreign policy advisor to Rudy Giuliani on part of weekly phone calls there. Sat down in the White House, it's reported, not so long ago with George Bush and Karl Rove. Is this sort of neocon patriarch, is that view still, you know, somewhere high in the power saddles?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is, and although I wouldn't blame the Iraq war on Norman Podhoretz, I think we should put the blame for that on Bush and Cheney and others in the administration. I did read a very alarming piece that Norman Podhoretz did, which basically advocated attacking Iran, and it had a lot of historical inaccuracies in it. You know, it compared Iran to Hitler's Germany. I mean, I frankly, you know, I find these comparisons completely ignorant and very counterproductive in many ways. So the fact that he's advising Giuliani is frankly scary, and would lead one to think that perhaps Giuliani would contemplate a war on Iran.
But it's part of our world. Let's take a call from Vajpai in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Vajpai, you're on the air.
Yes.
I have three comments, basically. First, on Iraq, I was always opposed to going to war in Iraq, and I was interviewed in a local media, and I very clearly said that it's not the war which is unwinnable, but it is post-war. Now I hear all this punditry that we should pull out of Iraq immediately or in 6 months. That's a totally, totally impractical. We have done enough damage to Iraq, and if we suddenly pull out, Kuchnik or nobody, we are going to create more problems.
Vajpayee, our time is short. I see you've got an observation on Myanmar as well. What is it?
Second thing is about Myanmar. Please give me a break. Darfur is Chinese, shame Chinese. They kill their own people in Tibet. I was in China when Tiananmen Square massacre took place. And what happened? Nothing. You can't shame Chinese. And last but not least, I just want to say about the Colombia presidency introduction to Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad, I don't support his views. He is a dictator. But to introduce him like that was rude, ungracious, ill-mannered, and unbecoming of a president of a great institution.
Vajpayee, we've got it. And thank you very much for your call. Barbara Slavin, Vajpayee looks at Myanmar and says, you know, on the China front, you're not going to shame China. He was at Tiananmen. Mm. That's the pattern here.
Well, he may be right. Darfur, of course, we have a very organized movement in this country which has been working on this issue for a very, very long time, and the Chinese have taken notice. Unfortunately, we don't have the same kind of movement in support of the Burmese. It's a very small and isolated country with very few resources. It doesn't have oil like Sudan does. So it's possible that it won't have any effect, but China clearly is key here, and I would suggest those who care about this issue to lobby the Chinese.
We're going to look.
Tom, I would like to say that for those who doubt the effectiveness of the current primary system with Iowa being first in the nation, they should listen to our caller just now. He's very typical of Iowa voters who have lots of opinions and are up to the news sometimes more than we up on the news sometimes right. More than we are.
Tuned in, clued in, and he was at Tiananmen. Vajpayee says that's pretty. Pretty much on the front line. We're going to look in much more depth at Myanmar on Monday. We're not going to leave those images of the monks in the streets and the crackdown alone. We will go back to that. It's been great speaking with all of you today. Barbara Slavin, we look forward to your new book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, on Iran and the U.S. Coming out soon. You there with the USA Today. Thanks a lot for being with us, Barbara.
Thank you very much.
Anne Kornblut, always great to have you. Stay on that campaign trail, Anne. We'll talk with you again soon.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Jack Beatty, great to have you. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Chris Burrell, Julie Jupp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.